Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private eye and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and you'd like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or you'd like to be considered for a future segment on our show, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Vito is on the road, and Tom Shamshak, Bureau Chief of CrimeWire Investigative Bureau, is with us for the entire hour. This is Tom's first appearance on our Tuesday night show, and he will be joining us on a regular basis in the future.
Hey, Susan, good evening. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. Denny, good evening. Peter, good evening. And Bonnie, good evening. Our first story tonight that we open with is the Nicole Ledoux January case that comes to us from Pass Christian, Mississippi. Here are some of the facts. Shortly before 10 o'clock in the morning on July 29, 2002, Nicole, or Nikki as she is known by her family and friends, was found dead of a single gunshot wound to the head. She was discovered on the balcony of her third floor condominium. This 30-year-old beautiful woman's death was quickly ruled a suicide. However, the Ledoux family believes that Nikki's death was a homicide, and they point the finger at her husband as the perpetrator. Nikki's mother, Bonnie Ledoux, is here with us tonight, along with CrimeWire consultant and statement analyst Peter Hyatt. They will join us to discuss the case in a few minutes. Again, the facts are simple. Nicole Ledoux January was found dead of a single gunshot wound to the head. She was discovered in her condominium in Pass Christian, Mississippi, shortly before 10 o'clock in the morning on July 29, 2002. Physical evidence indicates that there was rigor mortis and post-mortem lividity to her body, which indicates that this 30-year-old woman had been dead for several hours. Her death was ruled a suicide. Now, I'd like to open up the conversation by going to Bonnie. But Bonnie, before we go there, I would like to convey my heartfelt condolences on the loss of your beautiful daughter. And would you at this point please share with our listeners something about your daughter, about her life?
I'd love to. And thank you so much for the intro and for having me on. She's described often as a bright light. She was from the day she was born. She was always vivacious and fun-loving and loved people, and people loved her. She fit in anywhere she was. She wasn't just a person that stuck to her peer group. She loved everyone, and she was a very popular girl. She grew up into a beautiful woman and had her problems, obviously. But she gave birth to her little boy, who was the light of her life, and just absolutely adored him. And she loved life, which is one of the reasons that we've never been able to accept that she would take her life, no matter what the troubles that she was going through. She just... That was not her. It was not her personality. It was not her, too hard to believe, just knowing her.
Bonnie, can I ask you, when they were dating, when she and her then-husband were dating, did you like the guy? Was he nice? Did you get that funny feeling about him? How was their relationship when they were dating?
Well, you know, we lived in Florida. They lived in Pas Christiane. So I never met him until they were well involved. I think once we met him before they were married. Yes, it was actually the summer of 2000. We went
there. But Mom's
there
first
and,
impressions are everything. So what was your impression of this
yes,
guy just
my,
like right off the bat?
My first impression was I liked him, but I was amazed at how much older than her he was. He gave off, you know, a good impression. My husband is actually a better judge of character than I am, and I think that he, too, liked him the first time. He started to get reservations later on, but honestly, it took me a long time to see the light where he was concerned. He's a manipulator, and he manipulated me and my feelings after Nikki was dead, and it took me a while to come around and to see him for who he really is rather than who he wanted me to believe he was. And I believe that he played that same game with Nikki. I think that at the end of her life, she definitely knew who he was, and that's why.
But did she say anything to you? You know, think back.
No.
Did she ever say, you know what, Mom, this it's not really working out. I'm going to end the marriage. I'm going to, you know, Zachary and I are going to go someplace else. Did she ever give you any hint that things weren't going well?
Well, she gave her hints, but not verbally. The day that she was married, which they came to Florida to be married, I detected in her a reticence that I questioned her about. But she was a good actress, and I think she wanted me to feel that she was doing well, that she was happy. And the only thing that she ever said to me during those 2 years that they were married was that he was really getting on her nerves about work. He had been fired from the casino just before they were married, and he didn't work for a whole year. And she just said, you know, her social life was nil, and she was a very, very social person. And I know since her death, you know, he effectively, you know, got her friends out of her life. And, you know, she was a very unhappy girl at the time of her death. But no, she was coming home the day after she died. And she had told us that it was for a visit. But we later learned through a lot of investigation on our parts, talking to people, that in fact the details were that she was coming home for good. You know, she was driving her car, her friend Nancy was driving her car, and at the time of her death, all of Nikki's things were in Nancy's SUV. Nikki only drove a little Mustang. So, you know, the story that she told us was that she was coming for a visit. But after the fact, we uncovered so many things that we knew that it was Nikki's personality to face us when she had something important to say. So I believe in my heart that she was going to come home and tell us that her marriage was over and that she wasn't going back with Nancy, because there was really no other reason for her to have driven or the two of them driven two vehicles with Zach for a four-day visit. So,
Denny, weigh in, will you?
Yeah, I'd like to bring Peter in if I could. Peter, you, if I'm correct, you have done some analysis in this case, statement analysis. Could you explain a little bit about what it is you've looked at and what your thoughts are?
Yes, and it's strictly from the point of reviewing some of the letters that have been sent to me, to whether or not they're truthful or deceptive, is there withholding information, is there higher levels of sensitivity, that sort of thing. So it's a terribly sad case, and I also express my condolences to you and you have not only that, but my admiration for you to stay with this. And I began, of course, with the letter that you had sent to the lead. He was the lead investigator, is that correct?
The letter that I sent to you, I'm not even thinking. I wanted you to have the 911 transcript, and that one I think you have. And then there are letters from the investigator, Tom Poste, that I think you have.
Yeah. The 911, who made that call?
Nancy.
Okay, because I don't have that, and that is one of the things that I really would like to see. But I don't have that. No, what I have is your letter to Tom.
Okay.
And then four letters that he wrote. I guess it's from a jail at that time.
Yes. He wrote from the Harrison County Jail after he was transferred there from the Mississippi Correctional Center. And those letters explain why he's back in the county jail, because, you know, he was convicted of, I don't know, five counts and sentenced to 40 years. But he said that he was doing his own appeal. So he was back in the Harrison County Jail when he was writing to me.
Okay. Because those letters are the ones that I analyzed. And
okay.
They show that he's, I think, above average intelligence. There's some rather unpleasant leakage in the letters that have to do more with his crime and than anything else. But in the point here, which is probably the most important part, although they may be linked, is that when he's speaking to you about his work in the investigation, he's not being deceptive. He is not about his involvement. It is sensitive to him that errors are made, but this is a man who is absolutely, I won't say covering up because that is nefarious, but in a sense it is. He is defending and protecting. There's still a we between him and the other investigators in this. And that we, which indicates cooperation, he has a vested interest in not uncovering mistakes that were made and suspicions that he may have. He was way too quick to jump on the young man that your daughter had seen that night, I guess it was.
Uh-huh.
He had a much different tone towards him, but the part where I believe that he is withholding information and the claim that Hurricane Katrina has taken everything out of it that can't be proven is that he does not want to cross law enforcement, and that's the most pressing issue for you, is that he does not want to cross law enforcement because he is at the mercy of law enforcement. If he's going to have an appeal, it's going to be facing an attorney general's office or a district attorney's office where they protect law enforcement. He needs desperately to be seen as one of them, and he is not going to cross them until his case is completely adjudicated.
Mm.
Okay. Well,
the part where he's being honest is in his own, just himself, the things that he did, the things that he suspected, but he's not willing to put any blame on the fact that the little boy, your grandson, wasn't interviewed, that the idea with the phone was not pursued, and it just has that, Denny calls it the smell test. It doesn't pass the smell test when it comes to the good old boy's mentality of protecting mm-hmm. each other's backs, even if it's by mistake or they've been told to overlook.
Okay.
He's not concealing something where he was part of that, but there are certain things that he says in his letter, you know, when he goes, he uses a self-reference, for instance, or he says, as far as I can tell you, he's telling you that he's limited in what he can tell you, and it may not be limited to what he knows, but he does not want to cross. He does not want to cross law enforcement, at least the date of this letter, because of the precarious situation he's personally in.
Right, which brings to the question, why did he ever write to me to begin with? I could never figure that out, why he wrote that original letter to me. I had written to him in prison a whole year before that and never, I didn't even think that he had even received it because it was sent back to me. He didn't receive it, but I was not aware that he had been told I wrote to him. But a whole year later was when he wrote that original first letter to me asking me why I wrote to him. And he was obviously more free to get mail in the Harrison County Jail. And so that started the whole thing, but I could never figure out why he wanted to start a dialogue with me to only stick to his story, because he knew, he had to have known from his past encounters with me that, you know, he knew what I was looking for, and I could never figure out why he started that whole thing to begin with. And then in that really long letter that he wrote to me, he gave me some crazy details that never happened. That
yeah.
autopsy that he attended, that
yeah.
that didn't happen there. You know, he wasn't at Nikki's autopsy because it happened in New York State 2 months after her death.
But did you notice his it's a little on the creepy side, and I know it's kind of sensitive, but do you notice how in his description of Nikki, and then he goes towards the breast implants?
Yes.
These are not the type of things that someone should be writing about being held in prison on what he's been convicted of.
Exactly. And to her
mother. Just a terrible leakage of his own. Even as he described her as a young woman, and then he goes down on the breast implants, and that type of, and then there's another critical area there is when he talks about depression and his mother dying, I think, and a grandchild being born within 1 mile of each other. Within 1 mile of each other. Now, people will say, you know, this happened within a 6 month period or a 1 month period. They wouldn't say geographically where that took place. And I couldn't help but wonder, and I don't know anything about his crime, but I couldn't help but wonder if there was a period of time there where there was a victim in that small geographical area, a victim of his. I know that's outside the realm of the case, but I think that's why he was there. And that's kind of an excuse for his behavior, because he was so utterly depressed. And he wants to speak as a psychologist almost in terms of the people that commit suicide who are happy 1 minute because they've made their mind up, they made their peace, they're going to go through with it. That's not generally the way that works out in those circumstances, especially if there is an issue. And Susan will address this. She was about to get free. She was at that most, statistically, the most dangerous place for a domestic violence homicide when she was about to be free. So I think he knows that. He's a smart guy. But there is still this strong we, which shows unity with law enforcement. And I can't help but wonder if it could be anything from being protected where he is in jail, or the fact that his appeal process, the appellate process, is going to have something to do with law enforcement. Because he's there. He is defending them strongly.
Right.
Even while he's... I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I was hoping that you know, he would be more willing to speak the truth or tell me what he honestly believed based on his position. But you're right, you know, he is at their mercy. And
Bonnie?
Yes.
Yeah, we've been listening to Peter here, you know, talking about that this former detective may not have done certain things himself, that he seems to be defending or protecting possibly his colleagues. And, you know, we're speculating on reasons, but some of the reasons, let's go back and address the investigation that the police did and see what he might have to protect them for. Now, for example, if you initially felt, I believe, that it just was not like Nikki to kill herself. So probably from that regard you had some suspicions or doubts to begin with. But at what point did you start seeing other stuff, in other words, evidentiary things or how the investigation was being conducted that caused you to be even more suspicious of the police investigation?
Well, first of all, there was no investigation. Not in the true sense. They arrived there, and within an hour and a half, her body had been removed to the funeral home. There was nothing as far as investigation concerned, and if you've read those letters from Tom Puste, he claims that many, many people were interviewed. Nobody was. I've talked to all these people myself, and nobody was ever contacted by the police, ever, not from day one. The only people that were talked to were ones that approached them at the scene before Nikki's body was removed. Even Angie, who arrived there at 11:30, said that the whole place was deserted except for one cop car and Phil's truck with his son. So there was nothing done. You know, there was no fingerprints. There was nothing was taken into evidence except for the casing that was found in the pool and the bullet that was supposedly found in the chair next to her. But all these things, there's no photographs proving any of it. But to answer your question, it was by the end of the week that she died, around the time of her funeral, that I just was in such shock and so numb. But I remember approaching Phil the night before her funeral and just saying, is there any way this could have been anything else? And he did not hesitate. He said, no, that's what they told me, that it was a suicide. Well, the following week was when I jumped on my horse and started following up on some things. And the more I did, the more bizarre everything became.
Tom Shamshak, if I might ask you, based on your experience as a police officer and investigator, private investigator, from what you know of the case, or the nature of the crime scene, or the scene, I guess I should call it, and this roughly a 90-minute rush to judgment, perhaps, of suicide, what's your impression of how this case unfolded from the beginning? Were there any mistakes made as you see it, or was this the way it should have been done?
No, Danny, there are a lot of shortcomings. My first impression was that this appeared to be staged, that she was posed. Again, the weapon that purportedly was used in this incident was never seized and taken by the police. That's incredible that piece of evidence was not seized. The lack of significant crime scene reconstruction, to the point of even, you know, again, trying to recreate what happened. How did that? What are the terminal circumstances here? I mean, with, you know, the photograph that I've looked at with the butt of the firearm under her left thigh, there's no reasonable explanation for that. And I've spoken to two seasoned colleagues, one very well versed in crime scene reconstruction. His immediate thought was that this was staged and posed. And another fellow who's in the forensic, bioforensic medical field, he too found it to be very unusual. And it warranted, the terminal circumstances of this case warranted an in-depth, multi-hour crime scene reconstruction. And that just was not done. And that's significant. Why I it'd be speculation and conjecture on my part. It was a rush to judgment. But what's behind all of this? That's the puzzling question here. And this case warrants, and it will receive further attention from the Crime Wire Investigative Bureau.
Denny, Bonnie, can I ask you, was the body cremated or buried?
She's buried, she's buried in New York State.
Were you able to plan for her funeral, or did he plan?
Well, we did it all over the phone, but he allowed us pretty much to do what we wanted to do.
That's unusual.
Pardon me.
That's unusual.
We paid for the whole thing. He didn't want to pay for anything except her headstone, which I don't know if you've seen the pictures of it, but it is all about him. And one day I will fix that, but his behavior completely bizarre, Nancy's behavior completely bizarre, but I was too numb at the time to realize it's all in
and that's perfectly understandable. Tom,
yes.
In a case like this, as a police officer, as the head of a unit like you have been, it, would there be anything left when they make the death certificate ruling a suicide? Would they still have a case file? Would they have anything whatsoever on these cases? Do they hold that, whatever they do at the crime scene, on a case like this, or do they just discard it and say case closed, that's it?
That would be contingent upon the standard protocol for each jurisdiction. There's no uniform requirement to, especially if it's ruled a suicide, they could dispose of the pertinent physical evidence, return items to the family. And in this case, it's very puzzling as to why the certain protocols just weren't followed. It's mystifying.
Peter, doesn't it say something that somebody takes the time, and you and I, you talk about this all the time on the show, that somebody took the time to write Bonnie these letters?
Yeah, I think that's what is catching my attention now, because I didn't know that at the start. I think that he wants to talk, and I think that when his case is finally adjudicated, where he realizes he has no more appeals, we may get more. But there's always the feeling that, hey, there's a brotherhood there that I can't break, and I need to be kept safe here, because he's a high target guy there. I mean, he's a very large guy, and I'm sure he can handle himself well. He's almost 300 pounds, but he's still going to be a target of others, and they've got to keep him safe too. So this is really going to be difficult. I think the key is going to lie in getting some form of information from some of the others that investigated, and find if there's a connection between the ex-husband, some of the people he worked with, and them, because the Dixie Mafia mentality is not always based upon crime. Sometimes it's based on some good old boys or families that go back, or just businesses that go back and forth with money they don't want to break. So there could be a lot of different connections there.
You know, we have routinely, unfortunately, on these shows and the cases we cover, a common thread in many of them, and that is the death certificates and the suicide or accident findings with little to no investigation. And people in the chat rooms on a lot of the shows or by follow-up email say, well, how can that happen? In some cases, nobody from the medical examiner's or coroner's office even looked at the body or visited the scene, and they signed off. And Tom, I guess I should direct this to you. Because I think it not only fits this case, but other cases. Would you say that it's possible that sometimes the ME or the coroner talks to the cop at the scene and will say, what do you think? And the cop says, oh, suicide, no question about it. And that the ME or coroner decide that's good enough for me and sign off on it?
Yeah, you're correct. Unfortunately, that is the case. There's a case here in Massachusetts that speaks to the point. It was ruled an accidental shooting. Amy Bishop, a professor from a college down south, shot six people, killed three of her colleagues after she was denied tenure. This has been on the national news media in the recent past. And just recently, the case here in Massachusetts was reopened. The police chief, local investigators, back in 1986, when this woman's 18-year-old brother was shot once in the chest, police at the local level told state police investigators, oh, it is just an accident. Wasn't thoroughly investigated, and the woman was recently indicted for murder here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And so, again, this happens for a variety of reasons. Familial influence on the police, incompetence, mediocrity of investigative supervision. There are a lot of variables that come into play.
Did you get this deal?
You know, we are running out of time. Bonnie, do you have a website for your daughter?
Well, her story is on the Crime Wire.
No, that's not what I mean. I mean, do you have a separate one, like Justice
Not a personal one yet, but we're working on it.
Okay, good. That's first and foremost, that's really important. And we always say, Denny and Tom, don't we, and Peter, that the person responsible is listening, or the person that knows listens to either the broadcast live or in the after broadcast. And, you know, that's a given. Denny, we want people to come forward and maybe with everybody's input from CrimeWire, we can also help you a little bit with the website or the Facebook page, because you should do both, to, you know, put some information out there that would be helpful so people can make contact and provide information anonymously and provide a tip.
Okay. Well, Cherry is helping me out with that right as we speak.
Okay, that's
and,
great.
And that should be up and ready soon.
Thank you so much, and we're out of time, and we'll follow up with you,
thank you
in
so
the weeks
much
ahead.
For having me on. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Bonnie.
Yes.
Our second segment, we're going to be joined by founder and president of the Q Center for Missing Persons, Monica Kaysan. And we're going to discuss the case of 19-year-old Megan Maxwell, who disappeared from Newport, Tennessee. The teenager called a friend at 4:27 a.m. on April 26, 2009, to say she would be home soon, but she never made it. Less than 2 hours later, 6:10 a.m., an off-duty police officer discovered Megan's red 2001 Mitsubishi Eclipse engulfed in flames. The car was totally destroyed. Megan's friends describe her as a social butterfly. Her family and friends have teamed up with law enforcement in several search efforts near where Megan was last seen and where her car was found near the French Broad River in Newport, Tennessee. Those searches turned up nothing. Police were desperate to find Megan, but sadly, her remains were found on November 4th, 2010, in, I believe it's Coke, C-O-C-K-E, County, Tennessee. The remains were found just a little over 5 miles from the area where Megan's car was found on fire. Joining us with Monica is Megan's mother, Lisa Maxwell. Welcome, ladies, to the CrimeWire Show.
Thank you.
Hi.
And, Lisa, would you, before we get into the circumstances of the case, would you tell us a little bit about your daughter?
Yes. Megan had just turned 19. She had just turned 19 about a month before that she became missing. She was a beautiful, happy, and funny, very naive social butterfly, as you called her. She didn't know a stranger.
And so she had just gone out one day and just didn't come back. You didn't hear from her after that, right?
No. She'd received a phone call from a friend about 3 in the morning saying that there was something going on with her father's. The police were there, so she got dressed, and she went to see what was going on. When she reached her father's house, she went in, and there had been a fight there, and she wanted to go in and check on her dad, and he got a blow to the head.
That was the last time?
Yeah, that was. Her father had requested for a truck to be towed from his driveway. Later we found out this was Jeff Stock's truck.
Okay, and then so do you report her missing at the time?
Yeah, the next day we did. She returned that phone call to her friend saying that everything was okay and that she'd be back in about 10-15 minutes.
Okay, and she never was. And then when they recovered her remains, has anybody come forward? Has anybody been able to provide tips or leads to the local police there?
Well, they have had a person of interest since it happened. He's in jail. He's not been charged with anything with Megan, but he has been charged with not being registered as a sex offender. He violated the Adam Walsh Act.
Monica, why don't you describe, please, for us this case, your involvement, your involvement with the Q Center with her.
It's been a very tough case, and let's back up a little bit. She called and she was on her way home. She had let her mom know she was on her way home, and so everything was fine. And then early that morning, of course, they reported missing, but the vehicle was found, and correct me if I'm wrong, Lisa, but it was found before the report actually went through, I believe.
Yeah, you're right.
That an off-duty officer had seen it burning. So pretty much not far, it's a hop, skip, and a jump from the father's home. Her vehicle was found, on fire by an officer going home. And so it immediately red flags, knew something was wrong, Megan was in real trouble. The community rose up, and an action began, pretty much immediately. I mean, there were people, we spent 30-some plus days on the French Broad, the Pigeon River, which also dumps into Butler Lake, focusing on the water, and there were many reasons why that we can't discuss publicly that we were focused on the water, but there was evidence found to believe that Megan possibly could have been in that water. So we just camped on it. I mean, we lived on it, we camped on it, and as well as many people in the community walked, several miles around all these rivers because it's they're very large, and some days you can walk right across them, and other days you could drown in them. And some days they're very swift, and other days they're calm. So it was like, working around all the different calibers of these rivers, and making sure we stayed camped, on them. Just we really believed that she had to be near there, and that's where her car was found as well, near there. They had a suspect from minute one. I mean, pretty much that morning, this person was seen in or about the vehicle. We know that he was seen in or about Megan. And could have had contact with her. And like Lisa said, he is definitely in prison, for being a sex offender and not registering and so forth. We hope that, something will come forth in the near future to make sure that he never gets out of prison. But, that's right now the police are still trying to piece her case together and get solid evidence. And now that Megan has been located, we feel confident that they'll be able to move forward in that investigation.
Tom, Monica or Lisa, either of you, this is a question from the chat room. We know that that Megan had phone contact with friends early that morning indicating she was coming home, but everyone's curious, who was the last person to physically see her, the last known person to physically see her?
Her father. Her father was the last person.
And that was about what time?
Between 3 and 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So there was a couple hours gap there before that other phone call. That was at 6:10, I believe.
Yeah.
And how quickly did they have a person of interest on their radar?
By later.
Yeah, by lunch.
Yeah.
Tom, in a case like this, someone that's been involved at the top rank, when a family member disappears from the community, and isn't there sometimes more that can be done with a person of interest who's got this kind of a record that could be done? Can more be done with trying to secure that person and do an investigation, or is it too early when these cases are first reported or called in?
Well, they didn't have sufficient probable cause to effect an arrest, and at that point, all they can do is conduct a thorough, methodical investigation, looking for, obviously, physical evidence, some documentary evidence, and that might come in the form of telephone records, pinging of where the phone might have last been, near a tower, and then testimonial evidence, establishing, the time-tested tool, the timeline, and where was she, who was in the area, and again, 5 miles away, this is pretty typical for somebody that's familiar with the area. He didn't go 20 miles. He went just 5 miles. And, I'm sure the terminal circumstances suggest that it was a person that was familiar with the area. And, Monica, is that the case?
Well, yeah, in the 5 miles, it's like 100 miles because it's winding roads that go upside the mountains. It's immediately rural, farmland, that type of really sharp curves and turns, climbing up a mountain, and then you have the river below. So it's nothing, it's like, like 1 minute you could be at CBS and the next minute you could go hiking. And they did have Mr. Socks in jail immediately. They released him for a few hours, but then they went and got him back. And so he has pretty much, for the whole time we were looking for Megan, he's been incarcerated. And then he was finally, it finally went to court, and he was actually sentenced. So now, you know, he's in prison, I think, doing 4 years. Correct me if I'm wrong, Lisa, but I believe that was his sentence. So, you know, he's been incarcerated pretty much from you know, he was picked up and brought in and released and then brought back and was arrested hours later. So, I mean, the day she got missing, he's been incarcerated.
But he wasn't charged with her disappearance.
No, but you know, there's, like I said, I'm hoping now that Megan's found, that the other physical evidence that they'll need, you know, will help them tie up this case, you know, so she'll have justice. At the end of the day, I believe that will happen. These are really good officers. Like I said, the community, you know, has been pretty supportive. It has been tough, though. I mean, there's, you know, in any community, when a person gets missing, everybody's like, well, you know, she's 19, you know, could she? But, you know, right away we had the car burning. We had her separated from safety. We had no contact, you know. So, I mean, I think Megan's case was a little bit different. And right off the bat, you know, everybody knew it was definitely an urgency to find her and find her now. It wasn't, you know, I know that the family never questioned anything for a minute. They knew right away something bad had happened.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But can I ask a question that's been raised in the chat room? Regarding the burned car, was it determined exactly what caused it? Was it an arson, clearly? Was it some kind of an electrical problem? Or was that ever determined?
It was an arson. It was.
Yeah. And the other thing, now, I was looking at one report that said the sheriff's department said that the so-called person of interest, Mr. Stock, had been seen driving the car. Driving, you know, maybe not probable cause for, but seems to be kind of a strong lead if a guy's observed driving the missing person, now deceased person's vehicle. What do you think, Tom? Is that certainly at least a good lead? Good lead?
Well, yeah,
to see somebody and
well,
then with his record.
Yeah, obviously he arrested for possession of stolen property. You know, and again now. Linking her, I wasn't aware of all of, you know, that factual background, but certainly there was a looming probable cause there for them to effect his arrest. And again, if they had him that quick, you bet your bottom dollar that he would have been examined forensically for traces of accelerants, gasoline, lighter fluid, kerosene. I'm sure that they would have tested his clothing for smoke. And again, you know, I don't know what the results of, you know, that forensic examination is. Did it go out beyond local authorities to perhaps the Federal Bureau of Investigations facility down in Quantico, Virginia? Anything like that happen?
The TBI has been involved pretty much from the ground floor of this case as well, which is the Tennessee Bureau of Investigations.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, you know, a lot of things have happened, and they're... yes, they have the clothing and they have a lot of things like that.
Well, again, you know,
Tom, can I ask you another question here? A lot of these cases we get, including this one, you have other agencies then becoming involved, or people wonder why other agencies weren't involved, such as if it's a local jurisdiction handling, why maybe a state agency isn't brought in, or a federal agency, and of course you get into jurisdictional issues. But could you explain the process generally about how other agencies are brought in? For example, if it's not a federal crime, people say, well, then the FBI's got no business being involved in the case. Well, could you explain how these types of things works and how other agencies are sometimes brought in to assist?
Certainly. The local law enforcement agency that handles that jurisdiction typically will, if it has sufficient investigative resources, if it has good investigators, it has good forensic technicians, will work the crime scene. When the case is convoluted, appears to cross into different jurisdictions, it begins to grow, the point of bringing in other agencies, you know, maybe the local municipality will then call the state police. But the local, you know, depending on the laws, the local agency has to invite that state agency, and the state agency just cannot go in there on its own. Likewise, the federal government, with all of its resources, cannot just go into a case. They have to be invited in. And again, there are, you know, turf battles that occur, and you know, particularly with these complicated cases, it comes down to you know, sometimes ego, hubris, and again, we're not, law enforcement is not typically that open about sharing in the pursuit of justice for families. I mean, that's something that you know, I think every case you look at has some dimension to that. I hope I answered that.
Yes, you did. Because sometimes I see in different chat rooms and blogs and so on and so forth, people suggesting to a victim's family. If
yep.
maybe they aren't satisfied with how the investigation of their loved one's case has progressed by the local handling agency, and they'll say, well, go to the FBI and tell them you're not satisfied and have them come in. And it's not quite that simple as just picking up the phone or sending an email as a private citizen, even though you're a family member, but, you know, a non-law enforcement person trying to get some other agency just to kind of force its way in.
Well, we all have to be careful, Denny, in a lot of the cases that we do, because it and to defer in other ways, because we can't upset anybody, and it is their jurisdiction, and it's something that, you know, families don't know about. They think it's easy. A lot of these cases, when another jurisdiction comes in, and it is because they're invited, but it's difficult when people want justice, and it's not something that's explained.
And there's where we come in, you know, private investigators, explaining, you know, the process, you know, educating, unfortunately, consumers of the criminal justice system. And it sometimes is very mind-boggling to people who don't work in the system. They see it as a Byzantine structure.
And that's true. I mean, even, Denny, for you on some of the cases that we've had, I mean, that's why, Tom, you're a godsend to us. And, you know, really, and for our listeners and for the families, because you are the guidepost for a lot of things that we've been doing, and it's important that people realize that that's why it's so important that you are now the Crime Bureau Chief. You know, and it's not taken lightly, and that's why, you know, we're doing everything that we can to strive for these families, as is Monica from the Q Center with the families, not only just for recovery but for finding justice. And you don't see a lot of agencies out there like the Q Center who are out there, who have been out there as many years, fighting for the families till the end. And, you know, it's not just this case. It's so many of them that we don't see or hear about. Just recently, you know, Monica was on another recovery of Crystal Souls in South Carolina, and that was week before last, and they discovered her remains. And, you know, her work doesn't stop, and it's just wonderful to see a family like the Maxwell continue to get justice and to be heard after the recovery of the body. Because there's many cases, as we all know, Tom and Denny, it stops right there. It just doesn't continue.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of meeting Monica this past summer up in Rochester, New York, when I was working with the Brian Sullivan family. And I look forward to involving Monica in our initiative, the Crime Wire Investigator Bureau. And look forward to working with her in the near future.
Thank you.
Say, Monica, you know, we encounter frequently, and I'm I suspect you do, but I'd like to ask you, you know, people, when something happens like this, a missing person or a death notification, are obviously traumatized, in grief and shock, so on and so forth, and don't think necessarily clearly for a while, in some cases longer than others. But do you find cases that you get involved in where had the families been a little bit better educated in what to do in these situations, ways to protect evidence, ways to get the word out, that type of thing. Do you find that people generally aren't prepared to deal with these situations and don't really know what to do?
Well, you find that in any missing person, because I think just the initial shock, you know, and again, like in Megan's case, you know, sometimes you know right off the bat what's going on, and other times it takes, you know, days to unfold. But I think all families pretty much go through the same, you know, shock pattern, if you will, that they just kind of don't believe this is happening. It all seems like a dream. They really don't know where to go, where to start, or how to begin. And so, you know, that's another part of our organization where we do try to help guide them. We do try to, you know, educate them in how to keep their loved one out there, but also give them something positive to do. Megan's family, you know, we had Lori down on the ground right away, you know, her mom teamed up. She got it real quick. You know, we've got to do this, we've got to do that, and get her out there. Let's get some posters. They got a florist in town. They put a yellow ribbon on every light pole. When you walk, it's so so real when you get into Newport, Tennessee, and you start down that road, and every pole has this huge yellow and white ribbon, and then Megan's poster right underneath it. It's just like boom, 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 boom for miles, you know, and you know, it just consumed the town. But that family, Megan's family, you know, did a lot of that work. But, you know, we had people on the ground educating. This is important. This is what we need to do. We would have one event after another, awareness events. You know, even when Megan was supposed to graduate, we utilized that into another factor to get her out there in the media. And her mother showed up at the graduation and things like this. So, I mean, it's so important to keep that loved one out there while people are out there searching, to keep the hope alive, that, you know, and to keep that community involved. You've got to get them and keep them involved the whole run, and it's not an easy task. You think that everybody wants to be involved, but they come out at first, but then they start, you know, well, you know, it's 4th of July, we have a cookout to go to or whatever. Well, 4th of July has nothing to do with a missing kid, because days don't mean anything anymore, dates and anniversaries, you know, and Christmas and all that, because they're so focused on wanting to find their missing loved one. And so these communities have to stay involved, and Megan's family and loved ones and immediate close friends, you know, kept that going and learned very quickly on what it took to get that going, billboards, whatever it took, you know, while the search continued for her. And it's just, you know, it's very sad that these things are happening everywhere in America, and these families are not equipped, and you can't educate them in a general function. You can't, you know, you sit down and talk to a mother who's never had a missing child and try to explain what they're going to go through. They can't even comprehend it because they can't wrap their head. But when they're in it, when they're going through it, the only thing that, you know, the best thing you can do is be there to help guide them, help make decisions with them, help keep their loved one out there, and in the meantime, get the best resources and the best things for the case to get in there and try to find this child. That's
Monica,
all you
why
do.
Don't you
I don't
talk
think
about
there's
the conference. Talk about the conference. Actually, it's right around the corner. It's next week that your agency is putting on.
Yes, we have, you know, we host a national roundtable conference every year, and Megan's one of our honorees that will be dedicating a wall on Saturday night, March 26th. But the conference starts on the 24th and runs through the 27th. And it's a free conference. I mean, you only have to pay for your hotel room, but we don't charge for you to come to the conference. And we provide all the food, all the you know, great lecturers and trainers. We have so many topics that we hit on. One of our dreams is just to try to have, you know, a constant, you know, education out there.
Talk about the families.
Susan's
going to
be one of our trainers. Susan's coming in.
It's an honor, actually. I mean, it's for CrimeWire. It's for the families. It's for, because like you said, when they are, you know, when you lose a loved one and your head's in the fart zone, you don't know what day it is. You don't care about a date. You don't care about... You just want it. You want answers, and so many of the families that are coming that we've already had on this show and spoken to, they still want answers, Tom and Denny, and they still want, just like Bonnie's daughter's case, it's an unsolved. It needs, the death certificate needs to be changed. There needs to be an inquiry. Things weren't right on the crime scene. What does somebody do? And I think that, you know, this is also an opportunity for people to get to know CrimeWire more. And all the other things that we are doing to change how crime is dealt with, the media, and you know, it's an honor for us to be represented, and And I hope that the families that do come, you know, will learn something. Where can they find out more about this? Where can they register to participate?
They can go to our website, which is www.ncmissingpersons.org. They can email us at qcenter@aol.com, or they can call us at 910-343-1131. And we'll get them registered Sunday, you know, on the 20th. We stop registration. We are very excited about the attendees so far that we have. We still have them coming in. Like I said again, Joshua Hancock and Megan Maxwell will be our two honorees this year. We have a beautiful candlelight service on Saturday night, which we shuttle all the conference attendees from the conference downtown. They block off the whole, you know, from Princess to Market for us, and it's a beautiful setting on the water. And it's just, that's your realization of all everything that everybody's doing constantly, you know. That's where you're going to hear from the families and have the impact of the entire, you know, process of having a missing child. But most importantly, I do want to say that Megan's case continues, you know, even though she has been recovered. And I know that's Lisa's message tonight. She really wants to send that out there, you know, that, you know, even though her child is back home, you know, she's in the second part of her journey, which is the justice. And we need an arrest. We need people to keep Megan's story alive and keep talking about it and not forget her and get this message out there that somebody needs to get arrested. You know, somebody needs to, she needs her justice and, you know, to have her final healing, you know, of what has happened to her. I don't believe there's any closure. I do believe in a resolution, and now we're seeking resolution for the justice for Megan.
Yeah.
Monica, we talk in the program frequently about solvability factor, and you know, from what I'm hearing, what I've read on Megan's case, especially this person of interest and being around the vehicle and all that, are you pretty optimistic that there is going to be a resolution?
Yes, I am very optimistic. Lisa, how do you feel about that?
I feel pretty good about that. I think there will be justice, one way or the other. I'm just kind of leaving it up to the police now. We found Megan, which was a blessing, but now we're leaving it up to the police department for justice.
This is solvable. This is solvable. This will be a forensics case, a CSI solution.
Is there such a thing as a CSI, Tom?
A crime scene investigation? Sure.
It is much different than what people are, what they think it is, as far as television.
Yeah, well, in terms of the you know, the forensics, this is going to be a case that's solved by science. You know, again, the materials in the clothing, you know, that takes a while to be analyzed, and I'm quite sure that the TBI, if it doesn't have the resources, will outsource it. Again, scarce state budget, they may have to, you know, go outside and go to the FBI with it, but or the alcohol, tobacco, firearms. You know, the ATF people could analyze it as well.
Dan?
Yes, I think it's a solvable case, and I think time's right on. I think they've, you know, they've got the vehicle, they had the recovery. It seems like a case that there should be, as we're using the term now, not closure but resolution. Yes.
Lisa, can you give the website, please?
Yes, it's helpfindmeganmaxwell.com.
And that's where people can provide information, or, you know, because it's important to have more tips and things that anybody knows, isn't it?
Oh, yes, and that website has it all.
Okay.
Q is who done, Lisa with Q has done the website, and it's been a blessing, I'll tell you.
And Q is a blessing. I don't think that people realize it, and I don't toot a horn that isn't tootable. And I think that people don't understand these last few months as much as we've worked with the Q Center, with Monica and myself. I am every day amazed by the families and by the integrity of this. And I mean, God bless everybody and all the work. It's time that we have to say goodbye. Thank you to the CrimeWire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, and the public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, March 22nd, 2011. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. The CrimeWire team welcomes your support and values you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Or if you'd like to hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, simply go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn the volume up on your computer and the show will automatically play. Good night.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard. When there is nowhere else to turn, visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the CrimeWire team. Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffin, Tom Shamshak, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you and good night.
Good night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
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 Thank you.